You are listening to episode 22 of the Drunk Sex Podcast.
Welcome to Drunk Sex. Whatever you're into, we've got you covered. So crack open your favorite beverage and join your host, Jen Wadke, for the Drunk Sex Podcast.
Hey everyone, thanks for joining me. I'm super excited to have Dr. Lene here with me. Hey Lene.
Hi. I feel like I should crack something open.
I know. I have nothing today. I'm so disorganized.
I don't have anything at my desk either. It's 5 o'clock somewhere, right? Isn't that the old joke?
I'll be drinking later on today because this day has gone to shit pretty quickly.
That sucks.
For my listeners who might not know who you are, you're also known as the Mama Sutra. You and I met quite a few years ago at school where you became board certified sexologist. I did not. Recently a professor of human sexuality at City College of San Francisco. Top 100 sex blogging superheroes. Come on, Lene, you're making me look bad. And you've been quoted all over the place too. Forbes, Huffington, Live Strong, Pop Sugar. You get around.
I do get around. Yep. It's been a while since we were at the Institute and there's been a lot happening, right?
Yes, definitely a lot happening. I remember really loving your class. It really resonated with me because I come from a teaching background way back when. So when you were talking about how we teach children sexuality and some of the, you know, pitfalls and the bonuses and things we do right and wrong, really totally stayed with me. It was my favorite class back at the Institute.
Fantastic. Yeah, that was what, Child and Adolescent Sexuality?
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, I teach a version of that for Sex Coach U also, Dr. Patty Britton's sex coach training center.
Yeah. Amazing. And you have two kids. So this is a topic that's near and dear to your heart, correct?
Oh, for sure. Right now they are 14 and 16. And, you know, I have a much different relationship with my daughters than I did with my own mom. You know, I've talked to my daughters since they were really little about sex and sexuality, and you know, my own mom was a little, not disturbed or upset, but just sort of concerned when I was going to start studying sex and in particular child and adolescent sexuality. And she was okay with it once she realized that I wasn't teaching kids sexual positions.
Right. There's a little, people hear sex education and they can get a little riled up, not really knowing what it means. And then it's more about arming our adolescents and youth with tools to help them.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, I have a book that's coming out soon, self-publishing a book called Read Me, A Parental Primer to Having the Talk. And, you know, in this book, I talk about something I call the 5 building blocks to a healthy sexuality. And they are communication, consent, respect, pleasure, and fantasy. And I mean, if you think about it, none of those things really have anything to do with where penises go or, you know, what penises going into vaginas or anything like that. It's all about these concepts that are kind of a much bigger, broader thing that that helps people get comfortable with the topic.
Well, and I think those are actually life skills in essence as well. Like those things don't just relate to our sexuality. I think that spills over into all elements of our lives.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah, definitely. I mean, consent alone, I mean, it's kind of become a buzzword right now, but it's really just, it's about permission, right?
Yeah. I wanted to ask you, you mentioned the talk. Now, do you use the word the talk sort of as a shorthand? Because I suspect you don't mean that it's a one-time talk. I suspect that you mean it's a lifelong process from the time the children are, you know, first 5 years. It feels nice to touch their genitals at age 2.
Yeah, and even sooner than that, right? I mean, in utero, kids touch their genitals because it feels good. So, but yeah, I initially the book was going to be called Raising Sex Smart Kids, But as we started to talk to people, people who are not necessarily, raised in this sex positive or have been trained in sort of sex positive techniques and measures, the word sex kind of freaks people out, as you know. Mm-hmm. And so we took that title out and just used that for, or used the talk as sort of this, the common euphemism people think of around sex, right? Also, social media gives people who are in the sex education, sex therapy, sex whatever field, a really hard time trying to do ads and right? I'm sure you have a tough time advertising your podcast.
Oh, I don't really very well because I'm like, you can't. I've tried on Facebook. You just can't.
Yeah. I mean, it's a shame.
And I think my website's probably blocked entirely because I use the word erotic as a tagline for the website. So Facebook's like, nope. Which is, it's insane. Like, I still don't understand what people are so scared of in like letting people live their lives sexually however they want. Like, what is so scary about that we need to constantly censor and pretend that sex doesn't exist, which filters down to our children, which, I think creates a vicious cycle.
Yes, absolutely. It's something that, we have a fear about sex, where it comes from, where it originates, who knows. Lots of times, I know my own fear at the beginning before I went back to school was really just sort of passed down from my mom, from my parents. If we don't help parents figure out how to deal with the fear or the shame or the guilt or embarrassment or, insert whatever adjective there, it just naturally sort of gets passed on to the kids. And most parents I talk to really do want their kids to have healthy, happy sex lives when they're old enough, right? Most of that has the caveat when they're old enough. Obviously, we don't want anybody to be, ushered into their sexuality too soon or anything like that. So, it's about helping people have healthy attitudes. And I tend to find that if a person has a difficult time talking to their partner about sex, they're also going to have a difficult time talking to their kids.
Interesting. I hadn't thought about that, but as soon as you said it, I was like, of course, that totally makes sense.
Yeah. It's not something that comes naturally, really, but once people do start talking, like once I start talking to people about this topic, they tend to get really comfortable and like, oh yeah, okay, this is not that bad, right? Like, we can talk about this.
Once you take the plunge and start talking to your partner, I think it absolutely becomes easier and I think it builds a different level of trust.
Oh yeah.
One of my favorite experiences about talking with my partner, I was in an open relationship years and years ago. And everybody knew it was all on the up and up. And so we had the most candid conversations and he could talk about his experiences with me and how they differentiated with experiences with his other partners. And there was no jealousy, there was no fear. And it was so fascinating to me because I never had that level of frankness before. And it was glorious. Yeah. And one of the things I miss about being in an open relationship.
Yeah. Certainly conversation or communication has to happen in a relationship. And I grew up in sort of a very, traditional way in the Midwest. And, being able to talk openly just was like, it was so uncomfortable. And, now I've found a partner who grew up in Germany, and in Germany, people are much different. Their approach is much more open and not shameful around sex. And so finding somebody who's also comfortable talking about sex has been, just really, I was going to say mind-blowing, but it's not the right word. It's so freeing. And, it really deepens the relationship as well. I would say, I was just talking to some friends this weekend about this. The marriage that I had before was also very different because it was very traditionalist, right? Like, this is how things are done. And you don't really talk about things, but you just kind of go in assuming that this is how they do it. So this is how we should do it too. And so I was saying that if I get married again, I have two very, very distinct ideas on how I want that to go. And that's something that I'll talk to my kids about as well. Like, I want them to be able to define the relationship, to define the parameters of, you know, whatever commitment they have, whether that's marriage or whether that's, you know, something else that they create for themselves. But really, it's just, it all comes down to being able to break down what you already know and really examine it and then talk about it openly with your kids.
So how do parents start doing that? For maybe they don't have quite so young kids anymore. Maybe they're a little bit older and you have like a 10 or 11 year old, you know, who you know is going to be going through puberty and all the hormones and you go, oh my God, I haven't had any of the conversations. Where do those parents start?
Well, I think the important thing too is knowing you can start at any time. I mean, it's going to be uncomfortable. There's going to be stuff that you'll have to probably uncover for yourself, right? What areas, what things in particular are not comfortable for you? And, you know, when your kid's a teenager, they're already seeing things. They're already hearing things on the playground or, you know, at school. And it's just a matter of like being able to figure out moments that are, I mean, I guess I call them teachable moments. They're the ones that come up when you're seeing something on TV or when you're driving past a sexually suggestive ad or, you know, there's plenty of language out in the real world about things that are sexual that sort of have that double entendre or the, you know, the sexual innuendo. When my kids were little, I tended to use those as teaching moments to say, what do you think about this? Or do you know what this, why this is a joke? You know, why people kind of refer to this in kind of a funny way. One of the things I can give you as an example, I think I wrote a blog about this as well. When my daughters were younger, do you remember that song by Rihanna, S&M?
Yes.
So that was on the radio almost constantly back when it first came out, right?
Yeah.
And so one day we were driving the car and the kids are singing that at the top of their lungs. I don't even know if they know what the words are or what if they know what the words mean. And so I said, you know, when the song was over, I was like, do you know what that song's about? And one of my kids said, sex. Of course. Yeah. Okay. I said, but those letters have, you know, they mean something. And I was just wondering if you knew what that was. And so we talked a little bit deeper about it by saying, you know, S&M stands for sadism and masochism. And it's really about pain and pleasure. And I think one of my daughters said, well, what does that have to do with sex? And I said, well, have you ever been spanked, but instead of hurting, it kind of felt good? And, you know, my kids and I would kind of joke around. And my, you know, sometimes it's not even like a punitive spank, but I'll just like swat one on the butt as she walks by to, you know, get her going into her room. And my daughter with the really guttural voice, she's like, yeah. So,
are you raising some little kinksters, Lene?
I think we all are.
I agree with you. That was pretty tongue in cheek. I think we all are.
No, I mean, in that sentence, in that interaction, she kind of made me blush as well, right? Because it's, I mean, you don't know what your kids are going to say. And there are so many times where, you know, I'll ask my kids a question and most often it's like, what do you know? Right? What do you already know? And I use that as an opportunity to correct or give more information. And I really don't, I try not to give too much information. Like I let them drive the next question. And lots of times they go in a direction I don't expect. And so, you know, if they ask me something and I'm really not sure how to answer, I'll buy myself some time. And it's the same for other parents too. And it's more like, well, let me get back to you on that. Let me go look that up and get back to you. I mean, usually I do know the answer, but back when I was first studying and I didn't know all the answers, I mean, I still don't know all the answers, but, you know, being able to buy yourself some time, but the key is you have to circle back. You have to circle back and give them the answer because then they learn, oh, well, you know, either mom's not comfortable or dad's not ready or this guardian or caregiver or this person I trust is not really somebody that's comfortable with this. And so where do I go, you know?
Well, and you're also reinforcing the idea that we don't talk about sex when it makes us uncomfortable. We just, which is not
helpful for anybody. And I often find when parents are asked a question that they don't know the answer to or they're shocked by the question in the first place, they'll say something like, well, who did you hear that from? And in their minds, they're kind of like figuring, who do I need to keep my kid away from? You know? And that's not the answer either. You know, that's, you have to answer the question. And even if you don't know the answer, you can always go back and circle back and get it to them. But the big thing for me was also, I also told my kids, you know, please don't Google these things. You're going to find that there are things you can't unsee.
Yes.
I mean, right? Like, you find things out there that are just things you would not want to, I mean, two girls, one cup, right? Like, how many people?
Oh, I think about the fuckarama all the time. For those who, probably the general audience doesn't know what that is, but as part of the schooling at the Institute in San Francisco, we had to watch this thing called a fuckarama, which was, I think, like 40 minutes like long that, or something. Yeah. And I don't even know how many, it was like a big,
it was like sports
screen,
like a sports venue to watch 15 different games at once, right?
Yeah, but it was like 15 different porn videos. And as a result, your eye didn't know where to go. And I was like in this room with all these strangers. And I was like, I'm watching porn with strangers. I don't know what to do. I don't know where to look. And so my eyes would like jolt around. And then I'd settle on something where I was like, okay, that I can watch that. Mm-hmm. That's okay. And then all of a sudden it would change. And I was like, not my stuff.
Not my kink.
But yeah, there are things that you can't
see. Yeah. And so, you know, the example I gave my daughters when we had that conversation, you know, don't go to Google, don't, you know, just look up information on the internet about sex, because, you know, you're going to see stuff that you probably don't want to see. And I used sort of a normcore, I don't even know if that's the right word, just kind of an average example, right? For me, the example of something I can't unsee, and it pops into my head every time I talk about this topic, it's Alien. You know, the movie Alien, where the alien pops out of that guy's stomach. You know that? I can't unsee that. That and Jaws, when the woman is swimming by herself and gets pulled under by the shark. Yeah, no, those are two that just really resonate. And my youngest daughter, you know, for being, gosh, I don't remember how old she was when I had that conversation with her. I think she was probably about 7. And she relayed to me or shared with me that the movie Bolt was something that she couldn't unsee. And I asked her for more information, like, what do you mean by that? And she said she was really disturbed by the fact that this dog couldn't find its owner. And I mean, from a kid's perspective, right? That makes sense. It's a big deal to not be able to find your owner or your mom or whatever. So for her, that was something she couldn't unsee. So
yeah. And I think that that's really great advice too. And something that I think falls through the cracks in our society, because, you know, we have Google and we can look up anything so quickly. And that, I think, for a lot of us with a smartphone too, it's an instinct to look stuff up, but you're not necessarily going to get quality information. You're not necessarily going to get the images that you're hoping for. Like, it can be a bit of a crapshoot.
Exactly.
Especially if it's a sexuality
topic. Yeah. And you know, there are plenty of parents who are really trying to be cautious with their kids and limit their access to this, that, and the other, but you can't protect them from everything. You know, they will have friends on the playground. They might not even be close friends, but they'll be on the playground and somebody will have their smartphone out and they'll probably be looking something up that you don't necessarily want your kid to see. So it's really not something that you can totally shield them from. You really have to have the conversation about, I don't want you to see these things too early, because, you know, they're exactly the same thing. There are things you can't unsee. And you can use whatever your own examples are to help them, to help illustrate that. And they'll put it in their own terms, like my daughter did with Bolt. You know, they do, I'm sure, have some example of something they can't unsee.
And so I'm sure that, I would imagine, I shouldn't say I'm sure, I would imagine that if they see something that they can come and talk to you and ask you further questions, or
my kids. Yeah. Oh yeah, definitely. I mean, I guess it's also, it's a benefit here that maybe not all parents have is, you know, I have a library of books about sex, ranging from, you know, the illustrated picture books from Robie Harris, you know, it's not the Stork and books like that. And I have anatomy books. I have a huge library, but my kids aren't in here looking at these books. Like, they're not interested right now. They're fully here for their use or to look them over, but they're really not interested. So I think
I wonder if in a different household or a different situation, if kids knew that those books were there but they were forbidden, if there would be a different draw, like, because you're so open and you've been teaching them these things all along, they're like, meh, it's there when I need it, I know how to get it. Whereas in my family, it wasn't ever hidden, but like, we also never really, I don't even know if I got mm-hmm. the talk. Like, it was just, I kind of found my own way in essence. And if I would have known at 13, 14, 15 that there were sexuality books I could get, I would have been in there like a dirty shirt.
Well, I mean, it raises a good question. I mean, it's possible that if I had these things under lock and key, my kids would be looking for them, because why are these things locked? Why are these things hidden? I'm trying to think of my own behavior. I probably was trying to find things that were hidden, because why would they be hidden? You know?
Yeah. I mean, I remember being at a friend's house at, like, I think it was in grade six. So it was 12 years old. We were there for lunch and we like went searching for her dad's porn collection. Cause we knew it existed. We found a magazine, the old school magazines in the '80s, and you know, we looked at it and we wanted to touch the forbidden at that age.
I mean, it's, if you don't talk about it, where do you go? If you put something underground, people are going to try to find it. So yeah.
Didn't one of your daughters find your vibrator once too?
Yes, actually, that was the very,
that's one of my favorite stories.
That was the very first blog post I wrote. And it wasn't even something I was necessarily going to write about, but it was right when I went back to school to study sex. I had a teeny tiny little bullet vibrator, kind of looks like a lipstick, right? You know, the one. And I mean, part of my care for my toys, I take care of my toys and I clean them and I put them away, right? So I cleaned this, but I left it on the bathroom counter. And gosh, I think she was probably six at the time, my oldest. And she, I could hear her sort of bouncing through the house, coming toward where I was in the bathroom. And I was in there brushing my teeth. And she, I heard her coming. So I took the vibrator and I put it in the drawer, you know, quickly just sort of tucked it away. She opened the drawer. She was going to get a hairbrush and she saw the shiny silver lipstick looking thing. And she said, "Mom, what's this?" I said, "It's nothing. Put it away." tried to redirect. Didn't work. She's playing with it now. And she says, "No, what is it?" she's playing with it and she figured out how to turn it on. And I said, "It's for your private parts." And she, by now she has it on and she's going across her eyebrow, her forehead and down her nose. And she said, "It tickles." And I said, "Imagine what it feels like on your private parts." And she, you know, she turned it off, put it in the drawer, closed the drawer and walked out of the room. Ta-da. That was it. And I was sitting in there like wide-eyed, still with toothpaste in my mouth. Like, "Oh my God, what just happened here?"
Harder for you than for her, it sounds like, initially.
she wasn't embarrassed at all. Like, it was just factual information, right? Like, okay, if it tickles, imagine what it feels like in your private parts. Okay. You know.
Now, do you buy into, that just reminded me, we often don't allow minors to, often, everywhere. Minors can't go into a store and buy a vibrator. And I think that that can be a little bit hard for girls who are coming of age, because a boy can make a fist and a girl, it's a little bit harder if she wants to experiment and simulate sex for herself in a totally safe environment, which masturbating is. Do you think teenage girls should have access to a vibrator, or their parents should?
My position on this is you'll even find kids, boys and girls, playing with the jet at a whirlpool, at a public pool. So they they figure out ways to figure this out. But in terms of teenage girls, I mean, I do think that when a young woman is interested in this, you know, we should be encouraging them to at least figure their own bodies out. You know, too often girls, you know, wait or expect that it's something that the boy or their partner does for them, you know, not necessarily heterosexual interactions, but they sort of expect that it's something that someone else does for them. And you know, there's plenty of adult women who, you know, still think that way. And it's not necessarily a, you know, a wholly healthy, fully empowered woman approach.
Yeah, I agree. I think, I think a lot of women have been trained to defer to men and that sex is more something for men and by men. And as a result, don't masturbate or don't know how or don't know where to start. And I'm somebody who goes to happy hour a lot and talks to strangers a lot. And it is astonishing to me how many women have told me that they don't masturbate because they don't know how. And they don't know what to do. And I mean, on one hand, that seems so crazy to me. But on the other hand, it's like, well, yeah, why would you? If, you know, raised in our culture, you've probably never been told explicitly that your body is okay to experiment and yours to play with and do with as you see fit. And they sometimes internalize these messages that their bodies are for other people's pleasure. And I think that's really a detriment to an adult healthy sex life and to interacting with your partner.
Agreed. And that's not to say, you know, my thinking that, you know, women should have or should be able to access a vibrator when they are, when they have the interest, not like, it's not like turn 16, you get issued a standard issue vibrator, right? Like, because I was 16, I wasn't necessary.
I think that would kind of agree.
Well, I mean, when I was 16, I wasn't ready.
You're ready.
You know, and no, we all develop at different rates. We all have different interests. You know, some people are more sexually curious at a younger age than others, and some people are late bloomers, and all of it is fine. And so, you know, it really has to be driven by the individual, I think.
I think so too, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not it's not a standard issue thing.
I think I was 17 when I first masturbated. And in hindsight, I clearly wanted a toy, but I would never have had, I didn't know that they existed at 17. I just knew that I wanted something other than my hand. And I certainly, like I said, my parents weren't shameful about sex, but there also wasn't conversation. So there was no, like, no going to mom and being like, hey. So I just found something around the house. I think I had one of those fat, smelly markers that essentially became my little, not even a vibrator, right? It came a dildo of sorts. And I just used that to rub. And I think, look back now, my OCD like kind of hurts me. I'm like, I can't believe I touched myself with that thing all the time. Like, cause I didn't know, of course, I didn't know how to clean a toy. I didn't know what I was supposed to do with it. Like, you know? And so that's, I think, the missing piece for girls. Well, for girls a little bit more than boys. I mean, certainly boys are missing, I think, being educated on good masturbation habits as well, but it seems to me that it's a little bit different for girls who might want to experience penetration because it's not the easiest thing to do with your own fingers.
Right.
I find.
Right. But, and it's, I mean, there, like you mentioned, there are sort of two different ways to go about it. There's a vibrator, which would stimulate the clitoris, or a dildo, which would be something insertable, right? Like those are a couple different things to experiment with. And I'm not sure yet. I mean, my kids know that I have lots of sex toys. My kids know that I have all these books and, you know, when they start asking, I will be open to, you know, letting them know what's what and how to keep things clean and all that jazz.
I wonder what, if any, issues or challenges you have had as the sex positive parent in regards to your kids' friends' parents.
Have I had any issues?
Has that been, how does that? That played out in any way?
No, it really hasn't. I mean, I've had a couple parents approach me, you know, friends of my kids' friends or parents of my kids' friends and ask if, you know, such and such was okay, you know, to be able to talk about X, Y, or Z. In particular, I'm thinking of a parent who came to me and said, you know, the daughter was over at a friend's house and somebody in the house, like an older brother or something, was watching Good Luck Chuck. And I guess there's some, I've never seen the movie, but there's some pretty raunchy language and some pretty descriptive sexual terms. I need to see this movie to actually see it for see for myself. But the daughter came home and asked, what does this mean? What does that mean? And the mom was very upfront and said, that's a sex act and this is what it is. And it was just very matter of fact. I said, yeah, it sounds like exactly the right approach. You know, you don't have to demonstrate or anything like that. But yeah, it just, you know, being able to be comfortable being upfront and say yes, no, you know, confirm or deny or, you know, clarify whenever you have to, and then, you know, let them follow up with a follow-up question. They may just, you know, do the equivalent of turning it off, putting it in the drawer and closing the drawer and walking away.
Yeah.
They'll let you know.
So does your children's biological father, is he still involved in their lives?
To some extent, yeah. They do definitely still see him. I think they would want to see him more, but he doesn't seem to be giving any negative messaging, thankfully. We seem to be on the same page about that. Either that or he's just avoiding the topic altogether.
Kind of letting you run with
it. I mean, they don't come home and say, well, Dad said this or Dad said that. So
I just wonder for parents that might be divorced and living apart from, you know, children, like have to share custody, mm-hmm. what have you. I wonder if there are challenges there in terms of one parent being more sex positive than the other that might.
Yeah. Yeah.
Make it a little bit more.
Yeah, it definitely happens. I've consulted with a few parents on, you know, how to approach that as well. Usually my conversation around that is, you know, try to have a conversation with the other parent about the topic and make sure that you can come to some agreement that, you know, you would like your kids to have healthy, happy sex lives when they get older. Sometimes it's, I grew up in a Catholic home and we didn't talk about sex. And I've certainly had friends who spent their entire educational career in parochial school where they didn't get any conversation about sex. And a lot of times it comes up as, you know, just thinking it's really inappropriate, right? But if you're not having these conversations with your kids, you could be putting them at risk of potential unwanted sexual contact, you know, when you're not being completely upfront, you know, labeling the parts, the right parts, you know, the right anatomical names and giving them, you know, just general descriptions like down there or flower or whatever. You know, if heaven forbid something actually happens or they're violated or touched by someone that shouldn't be touching them, sometimes if they don't know the right words, they won't have the words to be able to describe where they were touched. And that's problematic, right? You need to be able to equip your kid to be able to say, you know, my anus was, you know, somebody touched my anus or my clitoris, or, you know, they know the parts when they're taught them. So, it really equips kids to be able to be, protected.
Yeah. And I think, what goes hand in hand with that too, is that, you know, if you start teaching children about sexuality and in age-appropriate, you know, terms all of that, I think one of the biggest positives is that you are almost inadvertently teaching bodily autonomy. So in addition to the kids having the language to talk about their bodies and that somebody has touched them or what have you, they also really learn that it is their body to control and that they have the right to say no. And if they do and that's not respected, then, you know, they know how to
right.
talk.
I mean, when kids are little, when they're really, really little, parents have to do everything for them, right? That's just sort of the natural taking care of your child. But eventually when they can start feeding themselves, when they can start wiping and they can start doing more things for themselves, there really is no reason anybody should be touching them for any, you know, for any reason. So it's like, that's when the shift can begin of having, you know, like you said, teaching that this is bodily autonomy. This is, you have agency over your body. You don't have to let anyone touch you if you don't want them to touch you.
One moment where I perhaps dropped the ball. My nephew was quite young and being in the process mm-hmm. of potty training. He's from the time he was a baby. I just had this like connection with him. So my brother's like, oh, he's got to go to the potty. Like, can you help him? And I was like, okay, but like, I don't really know potty training children. I'm like, well, what do I do? Like, what? what do I have to help him with? Like, I assume getting on the stool and washing his hands. And he's like, yeah. And then, you know, just hold his penis for him. I was like, what? And he's like, yeah, yeah. You hold his penis for him. And I'm like, but he's like 3. He can hold his own penis. And I totally said to my brother, I'm like, nope, not going to do it. I just didn't feel right to me. And maybe I overreacted. Maybe I was not being sex positive, but I was like, I don't think another adult, I don't feel like I should go in and hold his penis.
I mean, my gut tells me that was probably a pretty good instinct for somebody who's 3, because that is teaching him that he can, you know, he should hold his penis and direct where the flow of pee goes. You know, the other thing I think is interesting with how boys are raised in America, we have them stand to pee all the time, right? In Europe, certainly in Germany, I know, but I think also other places in Europe, men will sit down to pee and they'll just direct the penis down into the bowl and there's no mess. You know, there's plenty of...
No pee left on the seat? And the seat's always
Well, they're
down?
Sitting on it, right? They're
I'm
sitting
sold.
To pee.
I'm sold.
They just sit down to pee. They don't have to stand up. Like, I don't understand what this... I don't know if that's... if this is part of toxic masculinity as well. But it's, you know, there's nothing wrong with men sitting down to pee. They just put, you know, point the penis down into the bowl. And
yeah, I never thought about it.
Isn't that interesting?
I guess maybe it's just men are
boys, you know,
maybe it's easier to like whip it out. And I mean, imagine if I had a dick, I would enjoy whipping it out and aiming it all over the place.
So, you know, all of my friends who have boys, when their boys were young, were constantly complaining about the pee splashing everywhere and having to clean the floor and clean the toilet. And it's like, well, why can't your kids sit down to pee? You know, that'll avoid a lot of mess. I don't have boys, so I didn't have anyone to teach that to, but I don't think there's anything wrong with boys sitting down to pee.
No, and that's such a simple solution.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Parents, it's okay to let your boys sit down to pee. And dads, it's okay to sit down to pee. You probably do it when you have to go, you know, dump as well. So...
Well, I think too, the squat toilets in Japan, and as a female, like I quite like the squat toilets. I know that some people really struggle with them, but same thing for men, like trying to stand up and pee into a hole, like, well, you just squat, let her point down. This is so much civilized, Lenny.
It's so funny. Some of the, what would you call that? Is that just like a cultural norm?
Yeah, I guess. It's in the sense that it's one of those things that we just, like, I think most parents don't think about it. I think they just do it because it's so, like, that's just how it's been done. Have no concept of why would you change this.
Yeah. It's, boys can get in trouble for peeing in public too, so might as well teach them that they can sit down as well so they can avoid some future trouble maybe. But yeah, I mean, you know, I took my girls to Burning Man and I had to point out to them how to sort of pee in that squat position that you're talking about with, you don't necessarily want to sit on the toilet seats or the porta potty seats at Burning Man. So.
Yeah. You know, I was great. I probably going to be TMI, but I was always raised like, oh, squat on the toilet and don't let it touch you. And now as an adult, I'm like, I kind of don't give a shit. Like it's sterile. You're not going to catch a disease. Like,
I don't know. Well, it's just that, sometimes in that environment, people get a little messy. They don't necessarily aim. It's not just pee on the seat at that point.
Oh yeah. Then I'm tapping out and holding it, honestly.
Yeah. Sometimes they can be pretty scary.
Don't get me wrong. I'm not sitting on wild toilet
practices.
I'm telling you, Japanese toilets, I need to buy one and get one in my house.
Oh, like, the ones that have heated seats and water.
Oh, like everything.
Yeah.
Everything. Bidet, you can adjust the spray. You can adjust some of them, the heat of the spray. You can have the spray move forward and back. You can adjust the pressure. They're amazing.
I have a friend who installed one on the toilet in the house here in the States. And we've actually been thinking about it, but we haven't done anything about it yet. But yes, Japanese toilets are the bomb.
Now that I've experienced that, I'm like, why do we not have bidets here? Like, why is that not a thing?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah, that was one of the benefits of living in Europe. Both of my kids were raised in Europe for the first 3 and 5 years of their lives. And bidet. Oh, yeah. Having a bidet in the house was, yeah, quick, easy. Super good cleaning practices.
Well, I don't know. Should we, do you have anything else you wanted to go over?
Right now I am at the tail end of a website redesign. And up until recently, I've been, you mentioned at the beginning, at the top of the show, that I was teaching human sexuality at City College of San Francisco, a local community college. And this year I'm taking off, or I've ended that assignment, because I'm going to try to do this on my own and start to do some more individual coaching and some online courses and things like that. So I've got sort of two things in the hopper. One is education specifically for parents. And then the other is sort of like this, a more general sex ed for adults in general. So it'll help the parents and it'll help, you know, the other folks who aren't necessarily yet parents, or maybe they don't have any interest in being parents, but it's good information that they can have at any time. So that'll be coming out with my new website. I think right now we're talking about beginning of February, maybe like around Valentine's Day. I have a book that's coming out, like I mentioned at the beginning. Yeah, the book is called Read Me, A Parental Primer for the Talk. And it talks about those five building blocks that I mentioned at the beginning as well, the communication, consent, respect, pleasure, and fantasy. I think those were also in the class I taught with that you were in, right?
Yes.
So it breaks those down, and it's not a book that you would read with your kids or to your kids, but it's one that can help you sort of break down why you do things the way you do, or, you know, make you examine sort of your own belief structure, or examine your history and maybe why we look at things the way we do. In particular, there are some things I talk about porn in there. I talk about virginity. I don't usually like to talk about the concept of virginity as virginity. In fact, I state a little case in the book as well. I prefer to talk about it as sexual debut. And in the book, I give a lot of reasons for that, why that's a more positive thing to approach it that way. And I've been doing a lot of work with Cuddlist recently. Are you familiar with Cuddlist.com? So no. Cuddlist is sort of an offshoot from Cuddle Party. Have you heard of Cuddle Parties? Okay. So Cuddle Parties, mostly a group setting. Cuddlist is a one-on-one deal. And Cuddlist has been partnering with lots of therapists because it's therapeutic touch, right? It's not sexual. It is really just sort of cuddling and getting comfortable. And for me, I have this sort of, people tell me I have kind of a mommy energy. And so I've worked with people who are, you know, who've maybe been raised with not such a tender, nurturing mother. And so we sit and cuddle and talk and just sort of sometimes just lay very quietly and just feel the wonderful feelings of cuddling. It ends up being very therapeutic. My kids and my partner and I cuddle all the time as well. So
that's one of the struggles of living alone is, I think about that all the time, is that I just don't have that same level of like human touch that you might get if you live with your partner or children. So every now and then I'm like, should I see if I'm sure there's cuddle parties and things in Vancouver. Every once in a while I'm like, do I want to do that? I'm not sure. A little scared, a little nervous, but maybe I need it. But I have not yet taken
it. There are people all over. I think it's just now in Canada, the US, and the UK. I don't think they have branched out, but I could be wrong. It might be in Australia as well. And I'm misquoting myself here, but there are Cuddlists all over. You just go to the Cuddlist website and you can look them up. There may be some in Vancouver. I feel like I've heard Vancouver before.
You can
look it up on Cuddlist.com and find one there. But there's actually been a lot of press lately, especially out on the East Coast. So I offer Cuddlist for people locally here in the Bay Area. You know, there's lots of tech folks out here. So I've worked with men and women. And the interesting thing too is sometimes those will turn into coaching sessions as well, just like the regular sex coaching stuff. because, you know, being able to communicate, negotiate, ask for what you want, be specific, you know, hear no, you know, learn about your boundaries. All of these things are super important as it relates to sex as well, right? So cuddling is, you know, perfectly platonic, non-threatening. You know, people also get to learn that they don't have to, you know, move into something sexual. Lots of people think that cuddling is sex, or that, you know, it always leads to sex, but being able to take that pressure off is really transformative for people, because sometimes they really just want to cuddle. They don't want it to become something more than it is, right? And to assume that that's always the case is, you know, it sort of minimizes the value that cuddling can have.
Yeah. I do have a male friend who I occasionally like go out for dinner or drinks and watch movies or whatever, and totally platonic. But I was like, oh, I can't ask somebody that I'm not dating to touch me. Like, that's crazy. But with him, it's totally cool. And numerous times I've said to him, I'm like, can I just snuggle into you? Like, do you mind? Like, is that okay? And he's like, totally not a problem. And it was like, snuggle inside and he'll put his arm around me. Not remotely sexual. Just, I'm like, I just need human touch. Like, we're friends. And it has been a great experience for me in terms of like, oh, I can actually ask for this, something that I need, and not have to be sexual, which has been really quite a positive experience.
It's really rewarding to be able to ask for what you want and get it. But it's also rewarding to be able to ask for something you want, have the person, if the person says no, recognizing that they're taking care of themselves, right? Doesn't necessarily have anything to do with you. They might just not be comfortable, and you can live through the experience of, you know, being rejected as well, right? You just say, thank you for taking care of yourself. And it just sort of moves on in a, you know, a safe way where people know what their boundaries are and feel comfortable exerting them. It's amazing work.
It really is.
Yeah.
And so
for sure.
So Lene, if you can just tell us your social media, and I don't think you mentioned your website. Is it live? For anybody who's listening and wants more information on where they're going to be able to buy your book when it's released and your work, where can they find you? And I'll put this in the show notes too.
So you can find me everywhere on social media as The Mama Sutra, with the word "the" at the beginning of it. Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. The book, when it's out, will be on my website for sure. And I know that we're talking about doing Facebook ads as well, so you'll probably see it out there. But again, it's going to be called Read Me, A Parental Primer for the Talk by Dr. Lene St. John. What else can I tell you? The website for my work is right now, it's themamasutra.net. It's up right now, but it's the older version. So if you see one that sort of has just sort of like a green, kind of plain green, but it'll be a much more colorful site when it goes live. And like I said, that's probably going to be coming up here early February, mid-February, themamasutra.net.
Sounds good. I'm just popping over to your site.
I'm going to pull it up myself. The old one, like I said, it's still pretty plain. It doesn't have much on it. I mean, honestly, it was sort of like putting lipstick on the old 2009 site way back when I did update the 2009 site, but this new one is going to be a much more involved, a much, much bigger.
But you've got your blog and videos on the old site here, so there's still lots of information for people to get started, and they can talk to you and
book a coaching session too.
Yes, Lene is doing a lot of great work. So please do check her out on social media and her site. And I'm looking forward to your book coming out, because
I will
be purchasing. Definitely need to read that. Thank you so much for coming on. We had a slow start with some technical difficulties, but super informative. And
right on.
Always
Thank
great
you so much for having me on Drunk Sex.
Thanks, everyone.
This has been the Drunk Sex Podcast with Jen Wodkey. For more sex talk, head over to the Jen Wodkey Facebook group or check out jenwodkey.com. Till next time, happy boozing and sexing.